coming up on Philosophy Talk.
You can't treat the working man this way.
The fairness fixation.
One day we'll form a union and get the fair and equitable treatment we deserve. Then we'll go too far and get corrupt and shiftless, and the Japanese will eat us alive.
Should all social arrangements really aim to be fair and just?
You know it ain't right to treat me like you do.
Isn't it nice to finally display your accomplishments, son?
Is it fair that the fastest runner wins the race?
Honey, look at all your awards. That's great.
He's my champion.
Well, I didn't know they made ninth place ribbons.
Oh, Jack, they got him all the way up to 10th place.
Doesn't an obsessive concern with fairness lead to universal mediocrity?
Our guest is Stephen Asma, author of Against Fairness, In Favor of Favoritism.
The Fairness Fixation, coming up on Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that begin at Stanford University at Philosopher's Corner, where Ken and I profess philosophy.
And today we're talking about the fairness fixation.
Fixation? Are you trying to suggest, Ken, that we're too concerned with fairness?
We've gone way overboard with this fairness thing, John. We give every kid a medal just for running a race, robs the race of any meaning, and discourages kids from developing the drive to succeed and win.
Well, what does that have to do with fairness exactly?
Well, let me ask you, do you think it's fair that some people are born rich and while others are born dirt poor?
No, I don't think that's fair at all. And we take account of that. We believe everyone's equally entitled to at least a minimally decent life. That's why we ask the rich to pay more taxes than the poor, so we can at least smooth things out and make them a bit fairer.
And okay, and do you think it's fair that some get a good education while others get a really lousy education?
No, I don't think that's fair at all. I think every kid is equally deserving of a good education. That's a matter of fairness, too.
Well, so, John, just apply your own logic and see where it leads for a second. If every kid is equally deserving of a good education just in virtue of being a kid, and every person is equally deserving of a minimally decent life just in virtue of being, I don't know, a person, well, doesn't it follow that every kid deserves a medal just for running the race?
That is absurd reasoning.
That's right. I'm glad you agree. Our fixation with fairness inevitably leads to the absurd conclusion that we should always treat people equally. I'm glad you agree, John.
No. You didn't get my point at all. It's your reasoning that's absurd. Let me make some distinctions for you that might help even you see things a bit more clearly.
Okay, I'm all ears, John.
Well, look, we got to distinguish three different things people mean by fair. Related, but different. There's fairness as equality of outcome. Everybody gets the same. There's fairness as equality of opportunity. Everybody gets the same chance. And there's fairness as just desserts. Everybody gets what they deserve.
Well, those are fine distinctions, but I don't see why they're relevant to my reasoning.
Because when people like you complain about too much fairness, they're usually, almost always, mixing apples and oranges like you just did.
Oh, come on. How so?
Well, you were using one notion of fairness to criticize a different notion of fairness. It can be perfectly fair in the sense of just desserts. Fairness is getting what you deserve. That only the winner gets the medal, because only the winner deserves the medal, as long as the race was fair, in a different sense, of everybody having an equal opportunity, everybody having the same chance, everybody starts at the same time. So you see, it doesn't logically follow that if you're committed to one version of fairness, you necessarily end up giving everybody a medal.
No, okay, I get your point. But, you know, I still think you're missing something, John. You seem to believe that it's a kind of default. People automatically deserve to be treated equally, and anything that isn't equal treatment, well, that has to be morally justified. Do I have you right?
Yeah, I thought I learned that from Kant and you. Take two employees at the same company, doing the same job, with the same level of expertise. Surely, they deserve equal pay for their equal work.
Well, why, though? Why?
Because unless one is a better worker, more dedicated, more efficient, or more productive, it's downright unfair to pay one more than the other.
But what if one of them happens to be my son or my best friend? Wouldn't it be acceptable for me to pay him just a little bit more, even if he wasn't a better worker?
No, we have a word for that. That's outright nepotism.
Well, what's wrong with a little nepotism, John?
You're kidding, right?
No, I'm not kidding. We're all a little nepotistic in our heart of hearts. I actually think that's a good thing. I mean, consider a parallel situation. Suppose two people are drowning. You can save exactly one of them, but one of them is your wife. The other is a perfect stranger. Now, who do you save, John?
Well, my wife, of course.
Well, of course. And if some do-gooder came along and said, no, you got to weigh up their virtues and vices, or you got to flip a fair coin, you'd say, bug off, because some people just matter more to us. Fairness be darned.
Well, fairness may not apply to all situations, but the point is, partiality has its limits, too. Fairness has a demand on us, and nepotism is flat out wrong, despite your lame attempt to defend it. I mean, what if it was a black guy and a white guy drowning in that sea of yours? Would it be morally acceptable for some prejudiced white guy to save the white guy because he was white and he happened to be more partial to whites than blacks?
No, I think that would be taking partiality just a bit too far.
Well, to test that point, we sent our roving philosophical reporter Natalie Jones out to take a look at the pros and cons of nepotism. Close up, she files this report.
When we talk about nepotism, we usually mean something bad.
He's my nephew.
What?
Luke is my nephew.
Michael, that's nepotism. Luke is getting special treatment because he's your nephew.
Yes, exactly. That is a very nice way of putting it, Oscar. Mixing family and business is a beautiful thing.
The employees on the TV show The Office were not convinced. But maybe nepotism isn't all that bad.
We disapprove of adultery. Theft, murder, all the things that are listed as bad in the Ten Commandments, and yet people continue to do them. They obviously feel they have a compelling reason when they commit these acts. And the same thing applies to nepotism.
Adam Bellow wrote a book called In Praise of Nepotism. He looks at why we do it and argues that it isn't always a bad thing. And he has some personal experience.
I am actually a pretty good example myself of the new nepotism, because my father was a famous novelist and I work in the publishing industry.
His father is the Nobel Prize-winning writer, Saul Bellow. And while Adam Bellow says he didn't get any professional help from his dad, he did become interested in the industry in part from watching his dad's career. That's what he calls the new nepotism. Kids deciding for themselves they want to follow in a parent's footsteps rather than being pushed into a job. And Bellow says it's not just a social phenomenon. It's in our genes, too. It's how our societies are organized.
Nepotism is the thing that makes nature work. All species in nature are engineered to prefer their relatives. As long as people are going to do it anyway, we may as well encourage them to do it properly.
That means making sure family businesses still function smoothly and everyone works hard, even if some people have a leg up. Sometimes that advantage might even make people work harder.
They receive the reward of being related to you first, but that isn't enough. They have to then demonstrate that they deserve the benefit that they've received through nepotism.
It would be best to have the same clarity and expectations for everyone, family members and non-family members.
Nora Wolfson is a business consultant and licensed therapist. She works with companies to make sure they treat employees well. And in her experience, employers need to be aware that they might be unconsciously treating family members differently.
The likelihood is that there'll be some things in the relationships among those family members that they have blind spots around. And very often, those things will actually trump common sense and rationality.
Sometimes those blind spots mean that employees outside the family may be treated unfairly, given fewer advantages. Or at least they could perceive the situation that way. In that case, Wolfson recommends addressing the situation, but focusing on the business side of things rather than the personal. She recently heard about a situation where a company hired a partner's girlfriend. The other partner didn't think it was working out, but was having a hard time bringing it up.
I would counsel him to talk about it from a business perspective rather than to say, you know, your girlfriend comes in late and it makes me mad, or I don't like her attitude.
Wolfson says people might have a hard time hearing personal criticisms of someone they're close to, but would be more open to hearing an argument about how their behavior is hurting the business.
I in no way do I advocate that we should just embrace nepotism and give up the attempt to have a meritocratic society. I think that is very, very important.
Adam Bello doesn't believe that nepotism is the only way. But maybe we don't have to pretend that it doesn't happen and can admit that it's not all bad.
People really enjoy doing favors for friends and relatives. It feels good. It doesn't seem like a bad thing. It's not like sneaking off to the track after lunch instead of going back to your job. It gives you a warm feeling.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Natalie Jones.
Thanks, Natalie, for telling us what Saul Bellow's son thinks about nepotism. I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today we're thinking about the fairness fixation. We're joined now by Stephen Asma. He's a professor of philosophy at Columbia College Chicago. He's author of Against Fairness in Favor of Favoritism. Stephen, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks for having me.
Stephen, tell us what first got your hackles up about fairness and favoritism. Were you the winner of a race in which everyone got a medal, or were you denied something that you thought you deserved on the grounds of fairness?
Well, all those things have rubbed me the wrong way at some point or another. But actually, it was I was raised an egalitarian, just like most other people in the States and in the West. And then and I was sort of doing a good job as a utilitarian, trying to maximize the greatest good for the greatest number. But then I had a son and became a father. And I remember I was at this conference, and it was sort of a communist revolutionary on one side of me and a Catholic priest on the other. That's a joke.
Sounds like you went into a bar. Is this some kind of a joke?
But we're all basically extolling the sort of egalitarian logic of treating everyone the same. And then I realized I sort of had this moment like I was in a Twilight Zone episode. I thought, I'll choke all these people to death if it got my son an extra week of life. Now, I know that's a regrettable emotion, but many parents can sort of relate to it. And then right after this, I happened to read a really quick little vignette in Confucius, where Confucius was in an outlying region. This politician comes to him to try to impress him and says, hey, we're so virtuous here that if a father steals a sheep, the son will give evidence against the father. And Confucius thinks about this and he says, well, where I come from, the son shields the father shields the son, and we call that virtue. And so these things together sort of launched me on this investigation of can there be an ethic that's based on, you know, favoritism and sort of family filial piety and that sort of thing.
Well, in our opening, Ken mounted a sort of defense of nepotism, but I mean, he really didn't seem to have his heart in it. But you and Saul Bellow's son, who we heard interviewed, you actually think a little nepotism isn't necessarily such a bad thing, but. Well, what's the relation between nepotism and fairness? I mean, it just seems like they're two competing values, helping your family and being fair. But competing values are okay, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, I think nepotism, it's interesting if you look at the history of nepotism. It's just a Latin word for your nephew. And historically, nobody was bothered by nepotism. It's a fairly recent attitude to consider it automatically corruption. And my own view is that this is because after the Enlightenment, and you had people like Kant with the deontology ethics, and you had people like you had utilitarian theories. This was the kind of grid of impartiality that the Enlightenment laid across all society, because we're trying to make a science of society.
But let me just ask a clarificatory question. I mean, when I think of nepotism, I think of a government executive hiring his nephew, or of somebody in a publicly owned corporation. I don't think of it as nepotism if the local grocer has his nephew make deliveries. Is that really nepotism?
Yeah. I mean, 90%, I'm told, of American businesses are family-owned. And so if it doesn't bother you that, the local grocer is hiring his kid, then I'm like, I agree with you that I don't think that should bother anybody.
Well, it bothers me, Stephen. And we're going to have to, okay. I want to explore the grounds of it. Well, I think a person who didn't get hired because I just preferred my son might have some grounds to complain. But we'll dig into that in a bit. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about fairness and impartiality with Stephen Asma from Columbia College, Chicago.
Are fairness and impartiality absolute requirements of morality? Certainly people do favor those who are near and dear, but should they? Isn't that just an expression of outmoded tribalism?
Favoritism versus fairness, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Is there any point in winning if everyone's a winner? Should Mitt Romney have an Oval Office somewhere because of his participation in our electoral process? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're thinking about the fairness fixation. Is our concern with fairness a good thing or a bad thing? Could there really be such a thing as too much fairness? That's too fair.
Our guest is Stephen Asma, author of Against Fairness in Favor of Favoritism. You can join Stephen for a live chat at our online community of thinkers on Friday, November 21st at 12 noon Pacific. Be part of the online chat at philosophytalk.org.
So, Stephen, I want to go back in a second to your defense of nepotism. I want to challenge you on that. But first, I want to ask something else. You seem to believe that what you think of as an obsessive concern with fairness has actually done positive harm in our society. That I don't get. But can you give me some examples of how a concern with fairness has done positive harm?
Well, I think let me try to give an example. The one that you guys gave earlier, I think, is a good one. That did actually happen to me. My son came home and said he had won this race. And when I asked him what place he had come in, he had no idea. It was like 10th or 11th. Everybody got the same ribbon. And then we were told you are not allowed to bring a Valentine for any of the students unless you bring Valentines for all of the students, because you could never demonstrate preferential affection for one of the students that would somehow wound the other students. And so now I grant you those are sort of trivial cases, but here's one that's perhaps more interesting. I asked my students the thought experiment here in the States. If somebody came knocking at your door and it was your friend and they said, hey, I killed somebody, and the details of it are vague. I need to be, you got to hide me. The police are looking around. They saw some shadowy figure. Can you hide me in your basement? When I ask my students here in the States, all of them, for the most part, will say, well, I'm a little conflicted, but eventually I have to give my friend up to the authorities because right is right, fair is fair, justice is impartial. But when I asked this exact same thought experiment in China, I was on a Fulbright teaching last year in China, every single Chinese student said, I hide my friend no matter what. I always prefer my friend.
Well, let's have some background. Which China were you in?
I was in the People's Republic?
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Who trusts the government there? I mean, who trusts the government to do the right thing? If I were in the Soviet Union or Nazi Germany and the government came looking for my best friend, I'd say, heck no. Right. If I'm in a just society and the government comes looking for my best friend and there's good reason to believe my best friend has done the thing, I'm not going to stand behind my friend when he's done an objective wrong. I mean, if I think he's been wronged, I mean, it's not that simple of friends versus the fair authority. I mean, that your example is,
well,
there's lots of parameters.
Yeah, but in this case, I agree with you. If you asked in certain neighborhoods in the States here where the police are not trustworthy, then of course you would also get this kind of response, and I understand that. On the other hand, there's thousands of years of Confucianism that have sort of contoured the ethical life in China, and Mao tried to root this stuff out with a kind of radical egalitarianism, and it was unsuccessful. Their notion of the good is not an egalitarian, impartial grid. It is a hierarchy. hierarchy in which the family is at the center, and then outcome, and then friends in a concentric circle after that, and then out and out. And so this is a tradition that Aristotle even would fit with.
Excuse me, are you telling me that Chinese families are happy if other Chinese families are given preferential treatment by the government because they happen to be the families of government officials?
No, the Chinese are just like us. They're against corruption, but they don't see nepotism as corruption like we do. They see that the way things are done are with, they call it guanxi, which means connection.
I still don't see why you guys keep saying nepotism in cases where we wouldn't say nepotism. I mean, if a grocer hires his son, that's not corruption. He's not using public money or his stockholders' money in an illicit way. But is that nepotism or is that not nepotism?
I think you're making a distinction that's important. So let's distinguish between the demands of the person who acts on behalf of the body politic or the general public from the private actor in a private sphere, right? It's certainly not wrong of me to Peter Singer would say it's wrong of me. It's certainly not wrong of me to lavish goods on my son that I wouldn't lavish on others in my capacity as just an individual person. Now, if I were the superintendent of schools and I lavished goods on my son's class that I refuse to lavish on the classes of others, of other kids equally situated, there would be something deeply wrong about that. So there's kind of like a different demand, a different moral demand placed on us as private actors and public officials. That's kind of
I'm saying if nepotism means favoring people in your family, then sometimes it's corrupt and sometimes it's not. If nepotism means corruptly favoring members of your own family, then it applies to public officials and people in publicly run companies. But it's not clear to me it applies to my grocer. Maybe there's in-between family corporations that are so big that they become virtually state actors.
So what do you think about the kind of distinction John's getting at there, Stephen?
Well, I concede that that's an important distinction to draw, that if you have some kind of, let's say I'm an alderman in Chicago and I'm in charge of building some special project in a neighborhood in Chicago. And let's say my brother has a construction company. Of course, the assumption is, well, as a public servant, I should not be favoring my brother to build a pool. And we assume that anything that would favor my brother would be sort of corrupt and illegitimate. On the other hand,
although in Chicago, we might assume that you would.
Well, that's right. It's a great tradition here of double standards. I would even call some of that into question as well, because the distinction between private and public is neat and helpful, but not at all obvious that it can be sustained. Human beings are both public officials and brothers and mothers and sons. And if I serve the larger public of strangers or citizens, I oftentimes violate my duties to my brother, let's say,
but
vice versa.
Stephen, I want to underline what you said, because one of your great opponents, you seem kind of obsessed with rubbing his face in his wrongness, is Peter Singer and the utilitarians generally, who basically say that in your private morality, you should act like a wise social planner. Right? A wise social planner has to treat all of his constituency equally and treat their pains and pleasures as each equal. And the utilitarian thing, the demands of morality are like that, so that I have no more right to save my wife in that scenario I gave he's the one who would come along and say, well, weigh up their pains and virtues, or flip a pair their vices and virtues, or flip a fair coin or something to decide. But a lot of us think that there's something wrong with that, and you certainly do.
There's an example of a early utilitarian. William Godwin tells that example, that there's a building burning. You go in. You can only rescue one of the people. You see a very important politician. Let's say it's the president or something. And then you see a chambermaid over here. Utilitarian ethic would suggest save the more important character. But then you realize, wait, the chambermaid is my mother. And Godwin just bites the bullet on this and says, well, you still have to save the president because he will do more good for a larger number. And my argument is, well, that violates the special duties I have to my mother, and I'm going to save my mother. Why should I prefer an ethic that is better for strangers and large-scale social institutions rather than my family?
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the fairness of fixation with Stephen Asma. We'd love to have you join this conversation. Mark from San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Mark.
Hi, thank you. So since twin studies, identical twin studies, show that a large majority of behavior, aptitude, intelligence, and performance are due to genetics, I believe that society should not reward or punish people for any of their actions, including the hypothetical race. So I'm coming on the side that either everyone should get a prize or no one should get a prize, or at the very least, the outcome should be announced as the result of these forces rather than any kind of personal diligence or training.
So how about, I mean, you know, to do taxes, you have to be a CPA. To be a CPA, you have to pass a test that says you can add and subtract and a bunch of stuff like that. And if you don't pass the test, you don't get to be a CPA. Do you think that's unfair, like giving a medal for the winner of the race?
I guess I do. So, you know, at least in terms of governmental actions, that, you know, the government should not be involved in rewarding or punishing people.
Really?
You might have to remove people, but punishment should not be a part of it.
Okay, Mark. Mark, you're really raising a different issue. You actually think there's no such thing as just desserts, that nothing is deserved or undeserved. And some people think that if they think, oh, there's no such thing as freedom, because in order to deserve something,
well,
you have to deserve freedom.
In terms of government and society at large,
yeah,
I believe that it cannot be determined, since a large part is genetic and most of the rest is simply environmental.
Okay, Mark, that's a different issue, and it's not really pertinent.
Well,
right, it's related, but we can have a whole debate about freedom versus determinism. Does anybody have dessert? Because we want to focus on the benefits of favoritism versus fairness, right?
Well, Mark it's not irrelevant. He's giving a very radical defense of the opposing view of our guests, but I suspect you're right. It's not the defense that will get the most agreement.
Yeah, Stephen, what do you think? You want to comment on Mark's thought at all?
Well, yeah, I don't share Mark's view that there's no... I think, as you guys were pointing out, I think John was pointing this out at the beginning, there's these two different notions of fairness. One is a liberal view, which is equality for all, whether that be equality of outcomes or opportunity, and then the conservative view of meritocracy or just desserts. These things are real. They exist. I think that when you're excellent, you should be rewarded, so I don't share that view. On the other hand, what I think is important is that favoritism flies in the face of both these traditions.
Right.
It really upsets the egalitarian view, but it also upsets meritocracy because my favorites are not the most exceptional, excellent human beings I know. They're my family and my friends. No disrespect to them, I'm not friends with them because they're just excellent at everything and
right,
everything
that,
great.
That was the example I gave to John in the beginning. You save your wife, but she's the least virtuous woman in the entire world, right? And the other person there is the more virtuous. They're still a demand, and there's a real demand. I don't know if it can be overridden, but it's a real demand that you save her rather than somebody, even if they're more virtuous, even if they would benefit the world more.
But look, I mean, most ethical theories, even utilitarianism in its more, I would say, reasonable fashions, rule utilitarianism, permits competing values, right? Someone might say, look, I mean, loyalty to family and friends, encouraging friendship with special bonds that mean special treatment, that is, even from a utilitarian point of view, a great tradition. So we should adopt rules that encourage that. On the other hand, equality is also important. So you have competing values. But now your claim is that we're obsessed with fairness. One of these values we're obsessed with over the others.
Right.
Now, I'm not sure that Valentine's Day and your kids' medal for participation and what you told us about the Chinese really make the case that we're obsessed with fairness.
Okay, I got another one for you.
Okay.
All right, let's look at Montesquieu says, you should rush to a stranger as quickly as you would to your friend, and ideally the truly virtuous person would have no friends. That's what Montesquieu says. And Gandhi says, you should never be close to anybody in particular because that would make you biased and partial. And universal love requires you to treat and love all people equal. And it was Orwell who read this in Gandhi's autobiography and said, Gandhi and the other sort of spiritual egalitarians are missing something very important about being a human, which is that you are bonded and have loyalties that are so deep and so strong that you'll kill and die for them. That's what it means to be a human being. Now, that I do think is trouble in either a spiritual egalitarianism or these more secular forms as well.
So, Stephen, I want to agree with you about a certain thing, because I do think that without special attachments to special people, human behavior would be radically different from what it is. I mean, I love my son, so I invest all these resources. It's a kind of altruism of a sort, biologists say, although it's not quite altruism, right? But it's a kind of altruism. And maternal love, philosopher Stephen Kitcher argues, that was the first evolutionary advance that leads to sociality, because mothers invest all these resources in their in their children. Non-social animals don't have that. Tadpoles, you know, just swim away, but all that.
Right.
But it's an important thing. It's a part of the and he argues that's what gets the moral project going. Maternal love is the first thing that gets the moral project going. So I don't disagree with you about that. I don't think.
Well, yeah, there's been some very interesting research done in affective neuroscience to show that you and I, human beings in general, bond with our offspring very similar to other mammals do, like you were saying. It's the system floods with oxytocin and opioids when the baby is born. There's this period where you have to touch and hold each other, and the oxytocin floods and creates a kind of the original bonding that happens between the baby and the mother or the father or alloparents. That's what sets up, as you said, all of the kinds of chosen forms of favoritism that we will evolve into as human beings. Now, other animals don't have that kind of flexibility. They're stuck with just their immediate families. But that bonding system, I think, is really fundamental. It changes the dynamic radically.
So as we sit here, the big issue in San Francisco is how many millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars should we pay Pablo Sandoval to re-sign with the Giants? Why? Well, because he's just so much fun and so good. You really think our society is obsessed with fairness when we're ignoring our crummy schools and our homeless people to focus on how much we can pay Pablo Sandoval, who I dearly love, to stay here in San Francisco?
Well, that's a good question. We're going to leave that one hanging. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about fairness and partiality with Stephen Asma from Columbia College Chicago.
Isn't there a danger that being too partial can lead to tribalism, nationalism, racism, and xenophobia? If so, does partiality to one's own really have a place in a cosmopolitan, interconnected world?
Tribalism versus cosmopolitanism, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Everybody may be a star to someone, but aren't some stars more important to us than others? Particularly here in San Francisco, the home of the world champion Giants. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Stephen Asma, author of Against Fairness, In Favor of Favoritism. Stephen will be part of a live chat or online community of thinkers on Friday, November 21st at 12 noon Pacific time. I hope you can join us at philosophytalk.org.
Stephen, I'm sympathetic with the idea that fairness could be overdone. It could run wild. You give medals to everyone who participates and not extra medals to those who win. You give Romney an Oval Office so he won't feel bad about losing. But on the other hand, xenophobia, racism, nationalism, all these things, these forms of partiality, they may be deeply rooted in human nature and character, and to a certain extent inevitable. But still, aren't they wrong? Aren't they extreme? Aren't they bad?
Yeah, I'm in no way condoning the kinds of xenophobia and racism that have happened in cases of tribalism. On the other hand, I think the tendency for us is to dismiss all forms of tribalism as either, you know, outmoded and primitive or just pernicious and always going to sort of the lowest common denominator and the worst kind of human tendency. I think tribes can be positive. They do not have to be organized around things like race or gender. They are oftentimes, in fact, with human beings, they're often organized not just around blood, but around even the trivial, like what's your favorite baseball team. People can actually have very strong devotion. My point is that this tribal, yeah.
See, I get you that not all tribes are bad. But tribalism has run amok in the history of humanity. So what I'm trying to figure out is how do we constrain tribalism so that it doesn't run amok? And it seems to me these cosmopolitan principles of equal humanity of all and all that sort of stuff are the thing by which we should constrain our tribal tendencies. Tribal tendencies are okay to the extent of that. They do not blind us to the equal humanity of the other. So fairness, equanimity, that's the fundamental moral thing. And tribalism gets to be okay within the context set by kind of cosmopolitan justice.
Well, yeah, I guess in this language, maybe I'm more of a communitarian, I suppose, than a cosmopolitan. And I think that you could tell a story that you're suggesting there, which I think many of us are familiar with, which is that there's a kind of progress in which American society is becoming more and more fair. You have the civil rights movement. You have the women's liberation movement. You have increasing levels of fairness and the recognition of autonomy and this sort of thing. On the other hand, there's another way to tell that story, which may be true as well, or perhaps instead. And that is that the civil rights movement may not be the triumph of fairness, but rather one tribe, an African-American tribe or another minority group fighting for its place at the table and winning. And so fairness does not unseat entrenched power. Power unseats entrenched power. And so if you look at the way in which we've become increasingly enlightened, it may indeed be this difficult sort of struggle between power groups.
Randall in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Randall.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I wanted to comment on the need for an objective harm of fairness. And I think the biggest example would be in media coverage of issues of the day, where, to be fair, we let two sides present their theory and nobody analyzes them, whereas I believe it would be fair to give them the same critical analysis. You know, take, for example, the flat earth versus round earth as a, you know, ridiculous example. But if they're taught in school or on the news as being equal, is that fair? Or is it fair to say, here's what they said, and here's the reasons why we, you know, value that theory or disagree with it? So that's my basic point.
Randall, I think you have a really good point. Thanks for the call. I mean, I don't think fairness to ideas is giving them all kind of equal opportunity. It's giving them all what they rationally deserve. That is, it's giving them equal rational scrutiny and letting the good ideas withstand that rational scrutiny and the bad ideas diminish that rational scrutiny. And the problem with the media, or at least some media, is that they just want to be the neutral referee, you know. But that's not all media. Some media want to put their finger on the scale, the non-neutral, non-rational referee. So they're complicated, Stephen, don't you think?
Yeah, I agree. My project in this book is to sort of look at ethics and our deeper value systems and how they compete with each other. But I would never go so far as to say, you know, creationism gets should be thought of as, you know, as fighting it out with science, and that we should give them, you know, equal treatment. I'm totally against that. Science really wins its truths by a process and a method, and we basically must respect that process. And so here's an this is a good reason why rejecting the idea of fairness, as the caller suggested, is something we should bring to knowledge claims and wisdom claims.
So we have an email from one of our regular correspondents, the always nuanced Greg Slater, who says, giving all kids medals for doing nothing special is a perverse result of the pathological desire not to do any psychological harm to kids. But that has nothing to do with the injustice between the elite and the bottom in our society. Talk about injustice, for heaven's sake, and not trivial stuff.
Yeah, so what is the point there? Is that there's a lot of unfairness that's really deep and corrosive, and so how can you be praising unfairness when we got all this injustice in our society? I mean, favoritism.
My view on this is not that I'm not sort of embracing inequality in society. My point is that fairness is a very anemic concept in ethics and in politics, and that it should be replaced by maybe older wisdom traditions. I referred to Aristotle and Confucius earlier, who thought about the society in terms of justice. That's a more full-blooded concept that would allow us to analyze what's really wrong with our society. Here's a simple example. When Obama and Romney were having the presidential debates, Obama was saying, everything should be treated fairly. Everyone should play by the same rules. But of course, his own grandfather was given the GI Bill and benefited tremendously from this. And the whole society, I think, benefits from this. And I'm very much for this. But it's a kind of preferential treatment that's positive and good. Now, how do we evaluate that with fairness? We don't. Giving tax loopholes to the 1% is a negative and bad form of preference. How do we analyze that with fairness? We don't. We have to have more full-blooded concepts like social justice. We have to think about the society like an organism, and our politicians and policymakers are essentially like physicians trying to do what it takes to make the body healthy. Sometimes that requires preferential treatment.
Now, one of the great philosophers of the 20th century, John Rawls, seemed to try to balance these things, but he regarded justice as fairness. And he said equality is the basic claim, but inequality is justified insofar as it helps the least well-off in society. So maybe giving Pablo Sandoval $80 million a year might not pass that test. 19, 20 million maybe? Surely that would be. So how do you feel about theoretical attempts like Rawls that try to, take care of both the advantages of inequality to the society as a whole, but are rooted in this equality?
Yeah, I respect, of course, the project, and he does this, though, by a kind of very artificial process where you pretend you have you don't know what your connections or your role in life or your own skills or abilities will be, and you have to create an equal society, this veil of ignorance argument, which I respect it. On the other hand, I think that Rawls is arguing for a kind of nemocentric view, the view from nowhere. What would it be like, if everybody was completely equal? But we are all connected. Bernard Williams has this great phrase. He says, we have these ground projects, which means, you have these meaningful ties to people and you can't divorce yourself from those.
Right. Rawls kind of abstracts away from the concrete reality of those to a artificial situation of having to choose together our lives. But I get your point. I get your point that we do come armed with these projects. But here's the thing. We don't really have time, but here's the thing. Once we're strangers to each other, in evolution, it was a small circle that you could hardly escape of kin and clan and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
But now we live in a world of strangers. And I think once we live in a world in which we're strangers to each other, the demands for fairness kind of wrap up. It's no accident that it's a late modern occurrence, this ethic of fairness, because, we're meeting all kinds of people all the time.
I think that's true, but I would say within that larger nation state institution, the elemental social unit of the family is still alive and well, and that's where we spend, 99% of our time. And I, 'cause you and I are, well, I'll speak for myself. I'm not a policymaker. I'm just interacting with people. And so the family unit is still the primary locus of value, even within the larger nation state. And so I agree, it's this difficult road of how to balance these two forms of ethics, loyalty versus fairness.
Yeah, this is hard stuff. We've just scratched the surface. We could say a lot more and think a lot more, but I'm going to have to thank you for joining us, Stephen.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Our guest has been Stephen Asma. He's a professor of philosophy at Columbia College, Chicago. He's author of Against Fairness, In Favor of Favoritism. So, John, what are you favoring today in your thoughts?
Well, I got 2 points about fairness I want to make. First is Election Day is coming up. It's maybe not a very fair process, and we do award the winners, and we don't give everybody a medal. But in spite of, even if you don't like those aspects of the election, get out and vote, for goodness sakes, especially if you agree with me. Secondly, I want to make sure that people understand that when I occasionally say nice things about San Francisco Giants, that's not nepotism or, you know, tribalism or anything like that. I've done an objective assessment, and the San Francisco Giants are clearly God's team. They're the most interesting, most exciting baseball team out there. And so when I say congratulations to the Giants for winning the World Championship, that's just an objective, fair assessment from someone on a national program philosophy talk.
Yeah, right. You know, I'll say this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner, at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is, get this, cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you too can become a partner in that community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org. And please join us at the Community of Thinkers Friday, November 21st at 12 noon Pacific for a live online chat with today's guest, Stephen Asma.
Now, we don't give medals to all the fast-talking philosophers in the world. Only the winner, the fastest-talking philosopher in the world, Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, some are worried that there's an epidemic, not of Ebola, but of fairness. I'm not seeing it myself. The example trotted out is a kid who comes home with a medal for running a race, and it turns out everybody in the race got a medal, because everybody's a winner, you see. Tetherball is another example. It's a ball game without a game. Hence, no competition. Hence, no winner or loser. Hence, no unfairness. A ball on a rope and pole. Kid swings at it until the ball is hit. No home runs, no pop flies, no strikeouts. Everybody goes home unbruised by failure. Some are upset that this outbreak of fairness may have a negative effect on our capitalist way of life. We should be more Ayn Rand about things. This dog-eat-dog, the best man wins. Quit propping up losers. Democracy is for saps, egalitarian, schmetalitarian. Why help others unless we have a stake in them? We owe more to our family and friends than we do to strangers. I don't think it's a controversial claim that nepotism and favoritism are not only unavoidable, they offer certain advantages. Look at American history. Despite our all-men-are-created-equal shtick, we are in fact led by magical power-infused families like the Roosevelts, the Adamses, Kennedys, Bushes, Clintons. And America has families that are puzzling in their stature, like the Robertsons of Duck Dynasty, Honey Boo Boo's extended family, and the Kardashians. But if today we have powerful capitalist families like the Koch brothers, the Waltons, and the Kardashians, remember that there are scores of once-powerful families that have gone off the radar, like the Vanderbilts, the Rockefellers. In some places, only the name remains, like Warner Brothers, Ford, Westinghouse, Fox. What happened to the Bonannos, the Rothschilds, the Gandhis, the Kahns? Well, they come and go. It can happen that one family will leap into power and do its best to make sure that rival families are wiped out. That is why Macduff's adorable little boy is murdered in Macbeth. It's the plot of most Chinese period action movies, when the lone survivor of a massacred clan grows up to become a handsome and fierce young warrior who exacts revenge on the evil emperor using only a sword and kung fu. Now wait, isn't that Star Wars, kind of? And families can be their own worst enemy. Look at the Habsburgs. That family ruled Spain until the 17th century, and Charles II, who was physically and mentally disabled, epileptic, infertile, and probably impotent anyway. There was an entire desperate bureaucracy around him designed to help him deliver an heir. Too bad the bureaucracy couldn't have the heir for him. But come to think of it, that's kind of the way the world is. The dynasties work until they don't anymore. At the top of the letterhead, you have the Lancasters and Yorks and Tudors and Medicis and Gambinos. But they don't actually do anything. They're the chiefs and generals and princes. It's the grunts who do the doing, the minions and orcs and bureaucrats and soldiers. And long after the families are gone, the name remains and the reputation, like Woolworths or Sears. Then the reputation fades, replaced by branding. And when branding doesn't work, the business is sold to a giant mega corporation, sold for parts, and the whole process begins again. The point is, it might not be fair, but some of us will be mighty captains of industry, and some of us will be bitter drones in a cube. What about professional athletes? Well, clearly, even as children, they got their competitive skills from somewhere, and it probably wasn't whacking at a tetherball. But I have a hunch World Series winners do allow their names to be licensed by tetherball manufacturers, and so we are all part of the great circle of life. In other words, we all get a medal in this epic race, and then we die. I gotta go.
Philosopher- Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2014.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Dave Millar is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Carola Kreitmeier, Jimmy Tobin, Jill Covington, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Those who are able to work the stock market and amass huge fortunes on capital gains are paying a lower tax rate than their secretaries. That's not fair.